Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
My friend goes everywhere with me, and I never leave the house without my friend.
You're just about to give up your friend, though, aren't you?
Yes, I'm trying, but it's pretty hard to leave the cigarette packet behind. That friend's always there no matter what. Never walks away on me.
Even though he's doing you wrong, really.
Yeah.
They say I'm doing you wrong.
Natasha Mitchell joining you for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Welcome. Today, the insidious nature of cigarette addiction and the neurobiology of nicotine. And a new anti-smoking drug on the market. Its mechanics are quite different to traditional nicotine replacement therapies. But its launch in the USA and Britain has been shrouded in controversy over potentially nasty side effects. Now it carries a warning, but what's the drug? And what's part of the process of withdrawal? And are we too fixed on a quick fix for addiction anyway? Producer Anita Barrow is your guide today.
One of the things that nicotine does when you take it in very rapidly from cigarette smoke is it sets up a kind of habit pattern where you have a cue, you smoke the cigarette, it causes neurochemical changes in the brain which tell the brain whatever you were doing just before that is a good thing to do and you should do it again. So in that way it builds up a kind of loop or a cycle in which you feel the impulse to smoke whenever particular situations arise. But another thing that it does is that it makes other things that are slightly enjoyable in your life more enjoyable. So it acts as a kind of pleasure amplifier.
It's probably one of the most rewarding of all the drugs of dependence. In animal models, animals will self-administer this drug at a very high frequency. And we're increasingly developing drugs that can assist people who want to stop to stop and stay stopped.
How many times have you attempted to give up, and what kind of methods?
I've probably seriously tried about three times. In the past, it's been the nicotine patches that I've used. The longest I went was for about 6 weeks. When I decided I wanted a cigarette, I'd take one off and stick it onto my cigarette pack. Oh, God.
Liz, ruefully admitting the psychological games we play when trying to quit. Now she's trying a new anti-smoking drug that targets the receptors in our brains that normally love nicotine. The medication makes smoking boring or even disgusting. But there may be serious side effects, as we'll hear. To understand how the drug works, we first need to understand why some of us cling to the fags for dear life, despite knowing life will be shorter as a result.
I suppose addiction. You just feel like you want that. Like, I've just had a cup of coffee, a morning cigarette, so that's the start of the day, really.
You don't think you could start the day without a cigarette?
Probably could, but I'd be a bit stroppy, I think.
I started very young, and I have tried to quit many times, but I've been unsuccessful. So, and the reason I'm smoking right now is because with the society we're living with, stress and pressure. Smoking is the only thing I've got. I'm not a drinker. I don't take drugs. Smoking is the only thing where I can release my stress.
So it relieves your stress?
Oh, well, sometimes, yeah. Most of the time, yeah.
And what kind of methods have you tried to give up?
Oh, I tried cold turkey, the patch, tried to slow down, even the chewies, everything.
The stress relief is a very strange thing because smokers report this very, very strongly as something which smoking does. But whenever you look at the literature or you try and look at it experimentally, you don't find that. You find that actually cigarettes make stress worse.
Robert West is Professor of Health Psychology at the University College London and part of the team responsible for Britain's quit programs.
When you don't smoke, there have been changes in the brain due to chronic nicotine ingestion. So when you don't smoke, your nicotine levels are depleted and you start to experience unpleasant mood and physical symptoms, irritability, depression, anxiety, restlessness, difficulty concentrating. And then when you have a cigarette, these are relieved. Now, obviously, as an individual, you're not necessarily in the position to know, and neither is your brain, whether the stress was caused by nicotine withdrawal or whether it's caused by something else. So from the smoker's perspective, all they know is that smoking sometimes, or very often, helps to relieve stress. And they generalise from that to other situations, and they kind of think that, well, it'll help in every situation. And the truth is, it doesn't.
And you believe that it's the delivery system, the cigarette itself, that's responsible for that addiction?
Essentially, it is the act of smoking that people get addicted to, but they get addicted to it because of the nicotine.
But of course, smoking is a nice, easy delivery system. It goes straight into the lungs. It easily makes its way through the circulatory system and into the brain.
Yeah, and what that then does is tell the brain that the activity of smoking and all the sensations associated with smoking are a good thing to do. What that then means is that if you give nicotine via another route, such as a nicotine patch, it'll do something. It'll help to relieve withdrawal symptoms and cravings, but it doesn't give you that satisfaction that you're used to getting from cigarettes. So the nicotine patches, they do help people to stop smoking, and so do these other medications, but they don't provide a substitute for smoking. And almost all smokers want to stop. Almost all smokers have tried to stop, and they find it very difficult. And the reason they find it difficult is because of these mechanisms of addiction, which operate at a level which is not the level of conscious, rational choice. It's a much deeper, more basic level in the brain, because nicotine is tapping into pathways that evolved long, long before humans appeared on the scene.
We're learning now that when someone becomes addicted to tobacco, as well as other drugs, there are long-term changes in the brain. There are changes in proteins, there are changes in a connection between nerves, and it's a type of learning and memory, so that there are many changes that occur in the brain with addiction that last for many years or maybe indefinitely. We all know of cases where people have quit smoking for 10 years, and then with a stressful situation, they have a cigarette, and then all of a sudden, within a week, they're smoking a pack a day again.
So our brain and body are permanently primed by a nicotine addiction. And from studies of twins, which help estimate how much of a given characteristic is genetic, it appears 50 to 60% of being a smoker is in your genes. A large focus now is on trying to paint that genetic picture. Neil Benowitz is Professor of Medicine, Psychiatry and Biopharmaceutical Sciences at the University of California and a world leader in smoking cessation research. He says that nicotine hijacks the action of one of the brain's own chemicals called acetylcholine.
Nicotine, when it goes to the brain, acts on receptors, which are these special proteins in the brain that bind substances and sort of signal a response. And these receptors are meant for the brain's own chemicals. What nicotine does is basically hijack a receptor that's meant for acetylcholine. It's a chemical that transmits information from one nerve cell to the next. Well, nicotine binds to the same receptors that are meant for acetylcholine. When it binds those receptors, it then causes the release of other hormones, a number of different hormones. But the hormone that is most clearly related to addiction is one called dopamine.
That's the one that tells us that dopamine, having a cigarette is very pleasurable.
Dopamine signals pleasure of all sorts. So whenever you feel something that's pleasurable, a dopamine release is occurring. And when you smoke a cigarette, you artificially stimulate dopamine release to higher levels than the body would normally release. So someone releases dopamine and finds a cigarette pleasurable. There are other hormones that have got anti-anxiety effects or calming effects. There are hormones that have got stimulating effects. And when you talk to smokers about why they smoke their cigarettes, they actually get different benefits or perceived benefits at different times of day.
Those your cigarettes?
No, they were just sitting here and I got them. You don't smoke, do you?
Nah. Give it up.
Oh, me either.
Oh, boy. Enough of that.
That was enough. 25 big ones. Oh, boy. Got the energy now.
Whoa.
Hey.
Just focus.
Zero in.
Oh, yeah.
Bang. You know?
Me too. You know, the beauty of quitting is that now that I've quit, you know, I can have one. Because I've quit. You want to join me?
Well, yeah, since I quit.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Now that you've quit,
okay.
You know, you can have
sure,
one.
Sure, yeah. I can do that. All right. Cigarettes and coffee, man. That's a combination.
Today, coffee without cigarettes and the push to develop more targeted quit smoking aids and drugs. Anita Barrow with you on All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and as podcast. A new product on the market works very differently to nicotine replacement therapies. It blocks those nicotine receptors in our brain, so they and you are no longer responsive to nicotine. Its generic name is varenicline, branded as Champix in Australia and Europe and Chantix in the USA. But the prescription now comes with a warning after international controversy over potentially nasty, even lethal side effects.
Romeo is bleeding, not so you notice. So on 18th Street as usual. Looking so hard against the hood of his car. Putting out a cigarette in his hand.
This is my brain on Chantix. I'd heard it was the most effective stop-smoking drug yet, so I took it. Then those reports of suicidal ideation began washing in.
Miracle drug or something far more dangerous? Tonight, reports of nightmares, hallucinations, even thoughts of suicide, and its medicine you get from your doctor.
One afternoon, I was typing away at advertising copy. And as I did so, I began to wonder how I had succeeded in fooling myself that my life had any sort of value at all. Maybe I should just go downstairs and leap in front of a tour bus, or launch my head through the computer screen. And I thought, who was that depressed seventh grade goth girl who had just muscled into my brain? I hadn't thought of suicide in any serious way since I was a teenager, and that had just been adolescent posturing. I had no interest in killing myself. That's why I wanted to quit smoking in the first place. Derek DeCoff, New York, February 18th, 2008.
Words penned by a New York advertising copywriter, vividly recounting his Chantix experience. He's one of an estimated 6.5 million people around the world who've bought the drug. Before we get to the controversy, how is the drug supposed to work? Wayne Hall is Professor of Public Health Policy at the University of Queensland and an international leader in addiction research.
Well, in the jargon, it's a nicotine partial agonist, meaning that it's a drug that produces some but not all of the effects that nicotine does, and it produces these effects at a lower level than nicotine would. It also seems to occupy the receptors, those sites in the brain where nicotine acts, so that if people are taking it and they do slip and have a cigarette, they're likely to find the effects of that cigarette much less rewarding than they would if they weren't taking the drug.
Now, there's been a number of clinical trials, and one of them had 44% quit smoking, and it dropped down, I think, after about a year to about 23%. But that's still very good in these kinds of trials. Are we seeing a magic pill here, or is that overstating it?
Well, I think it'd be overstating it. It looks on the basis of the trials done to date to be more effective than the other drug that's out there, which is bupropion or Zyban, as it's known by its trade name. So it roughly doubles, a bit less than doubling the success rate of Zyban, and probably nearly tripling the chance of quitting if people don't use any of those drugs.
I say to people, I just one day forgot to smoke, which was very interesting, and I found it a very strange experience to actually not have the cravings and to have forgotten to smoke. People around me noticed that I may have been slightly more forgetful, but I really put that down to not having the edginess associated with nicotine.
Peter has just completed a course of varenicline, or Champix.
I finished the course about 3 days ago, and I sort of noticed a little bit of maybe the old craving, but it's more of just feeling a lack of something than wanting to have a cigarette. I found that towards the day 12 that I was just picking up cigarettes and putting them back out, and then finally I went, this is disgusting, I can't stand it, and stopped smoking.
Sounds remarkable, doesn't it? But the story is different for Liz, who's found the side effects debilitating but is soldiering on.
Unfortunately, I've had nausea, which was a bit of a shame. So it sort of threw me a bit, but at one stage there, I thought I'd have to give up the Champix. because of the nausea.
How bad is the nausea?
Well, bad enough to make you vomit. So I had to take another tablet to counteract that. The only other thing was I was a bit worried about the dreams that I had early on with the Champix, but they seem to have gone now.
What kind of dreams?
Incredibly intense sort of anxiety dreams.
All medications have side effects, and nausea and bad dreams are common with the smoking cessation drug varenicline or Champix, newly introduced in Australia. More serious are reports of 37 suicides of people in the US who were taking the drug known there as Chantix. The US Federal Drug Administration has received more than 600 adverse reaction reports, including suicidal thoughts, severe nausea, and aggression.
I like the way you smile at me.
They were soulmates and deeply in love.
Makes me think of how.
Carter Albrecht was a musical genius. Not a violent bone in his body until he snapped.
My future's been stolen from me.
According to his girlfriend, Ryan Rathbone, it happened after a few drinks and taking his first 1 milligram tablet of the anti-smoking pill, Chantix.
On the floor, and he stopped, and he was like, baby, baby, what, who did this to you? He had no idea.
Ryan says he was delusional. Then, minutes later, Albrecht was dead, shot and killed, breaking into a neighbor's house. Carter's father has his theory.
That was not Carter Albrecht. That was some reaction, I feel, to this smoking drug.
Pfizer states the drug is safe.
Our analysis to date does not suggest a causal association between Chantix and violent behavior.
The much-reported case of the Dallas musician Carter Albrecht, whose behaviour spiralled out of control at the same time he was taking Champix. But he also had a lot of booze in his system at the time, 3 times the legal limit for driving a car. Professor Neil Benowitz says the problem is separating out cause and effect. Is the drug to blame, or are these behaviours part of the difficult process of withdrawal itself?
I don't know how many there have been, and I think there's some discrepancy between various numbers, but the fact of the matter is there are some people who have severe psychiatric problems. But to put it in the broader perspective, people who quit smoking have, in many cases, severe mood disorders. If you have a history of severe depression before you quit smoking, you're much more likely to have severe depression as part of your withdrawal. Many years ago, cases were reported where people who had been depressed in the past, when they tried to quit smoking, became suicidal. And this is without medication. We know in the U.S. that 40 or 50% of cigarettes are consumed by people who have other mental health disorders, so either drug abuse or psychiatric disorders. And whether there's some self-medication utility for these drugs or not, we don't really know.
I think one of the problems we have generally with drugs is that the post-marketing surveillance system is very weak. It's very poor in two ways. One is that what counts as a report of an adverse effect can be anything from a GP saying, I've got a patient who's experienced this and it's fully corroborated, to someone just phoning up the regulators or the drug company and saying, my friend felt that they wanted to commit suicide when they'd taken the drug, and then putting the phone down and you can never hear from them again. And the other side of things, which is, I think is equally important, is that we know that only a tiny proportion of serious adverse events that occur on drugs are actually reported by GPs. So you've got underreporting on the one hand, possible noise on the other, and with common side effects, it's not going to be an issue, but they would have been picked up in the clinical trials anyway. But with very rare side effects, then it makes it very difficult to tease out the signal from the noise.
But in this case, in a smoking cessation drug, which is going to target all sorts of people, including people with depression, and it's well known the links between smoking and depression, that's well documented. And yet, in the clinical trials, there are no tests or trials on a wider range of people who are the likely users of this drug.
I think the problem is that there are many, many different categories of potential users that you might target, and it's just not practicable to target, you know, all of them. So, and even if it were the case that suicidal ideation and other symptoms that were very rare were picked up on varenicline, the chances of those showing up in any clinical trial would be very small, because you're you know, we're now talking about these things appearing after 6.5 million users. So you're always going to be reliant on post-marketing surveillance to pick up very rare side effects. And that's why that system needs to be very robust, and it isn't.
In the US, it's not just controversy, but notoriety being attached to Chantix, as it's called there. There are calls for a black box warning. Ralph Nader has been on the case. He's one prominent person who's been calling for a black box warning. Many are even calling for a recall and a ban on it completely. You even get websites offering expert Chantix attorneys in a preparation, they say, for a looming, inevitable class action suit.
Yeah, well, I think that America has some societal pathologies, if I put it like that, and I think the move to litigate on everything is probably one of them. I think that people lose sight of the fact that smoking itself is extremely dangerous, and that it's really important for smokers to stop as young as they possibly can. Given that this drug appears to be more effective than other drugs that we have on the market and other treatments, then I think if you were to take it off the market or dissuade people from using it who could otherwise benefit from it, people will die. All drugs have side effects, and all drugs have to be seen in the context of a cost-benefit equation. And particularly in this case, where we don't know whether the suicidal ideation has absolutely got anything to do with the drug. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. So I think that it's always a question of trying to get the right kind of balance, being vigilant, monitoring, making sure that patients and doctors are fully aware of all the information, and then making a decision on the basis of that as to what the best way forward is.
Robert West, Professor of Health Psychology at University College London. And just to declare, both Robert West and Neil Benowitz have received funds and hospitality from pharmaceutical companies, including Pfizer, who make Champix. Pfizer would not give an interview about the drug, despite requests.
We don't want people to think that Champix is a quick fix.
Dr. Janet Randall works as a GP at a busy clinic in Brisbane. She's also chair of the National Prescribing Service, an independent body that assesses new drugs in Australia. She won't offer any intervention for smokers without directing her patients to appropriate information, counselling and support services.
Giving up smoking is hard work, and people need to be committed to that, and certainly we need to give them a lot of support while they're working through, particularly those first 3 months.
In your practice, have you prescribed varenicline or Champix to some of your patients?
I have. I've actually used varenicline for 4 patients now. They're all still working through. They're all doing quite well. They've all managed to largely abstain from smoking. 3 of those 4 patients have experienced some side effects, but largely the drug to date has been, you know, well tolerated by those 4 patients of mine.
What were the side effects?
About 30% of people in clinical trials experienced nausea, and certainly 3 of the 4 patients of mine have experienced some degree of nausea.
As a GP, how do you weigh up the pros and cons of a new drug like varenicline?
I'm certainly a fairly cautious prescriber and have been in the past, and so I'm careful with new drugs, and I think the trials that companies do to bring drugs to market very much use healthy volunteers in quite ideal settings. So we do need to be careful not to assume that those same results are going to be translated into, you know, the general patient population. So for a drug like Champix, for instance, it hasn't been widely tested in patients with other health problems who are on a range of other medications, and particularly for patients who may be suffering from mental illness. So we do need to be cautious, and I think we need to be giving patients information, and we need to be seeing patients regularly.
With the Champix, I mean, are you feeling that you will conquer the cigarettes?
Yes. Although I'm a little bit doubtful, it's almost like I'm hoping that I'll still be able to have just one occasionally, and I guess that's not the right attitude, but each time now when I light up, after 1 or 2 puffs, I'm really not getting any kind of satisfaction from the whole deal, and I usually end up putting the cigarette out, so I guess it's finally gonna, you know, kick in at some stage.
So what I've been doing with my patients is just making them aware that this is a possibility, asking them to report any change in their mood or behaviour, either to me or to the pharmacist, and really just to raise awareness. In Australia, we don't have, I don't believe, excellent post-marketing mechanisms to pick up some of these problems, and we're often relying on the States and the UK to get an early indicator of these types of issues. I understand that companies need to demonstrate that these drugs are safe and effective in healthy volunteers first, and that's fine. But I guess it would be good to see then some follow-up trials involving a more of a real-life situation so that as prescribers we can be more confident that these drugs are safe and effective in the types of patients that we're seeing every day.
Dr. Janet Randall, Brisbane GP and Chair of the National Prescribing Service. And there are currently further tests being carried out on a wider population, both in the UK and the US.
Do your family smoke?
Yeah, my mum does, my girlfriend doesn't.
How does your girlfriend feel about you smoking?
Oh, she hates it. Absolutely hates it.
So what does she do, make you clean your teeth a lot or?
Yeah, brush my teeth, but I've got to go outside. Yeah.
And how do you feel about that? You feel a bit of a pariah?
Oh, I don't mind. I respect that. I mean, if she doesn't want to wake up smelling the house of smoke or live in a house that smells like smoke, I don't mind going outside.
The message we need to get out to smokers is that it often takes a number of attempts before people succeed in stopping and stay stopped. But on the whole, over the longer term, people do succeed because we know there are a lot more ex-smokers in Australia than there are currently smokers. I think if we make it harder for people to smoke, which is what we've done, it makes it more difficult for people to sustain the level of smoking that maintains addiction. So I think one of the dangers in focusing on the neurobiology or over-focusing on it is to give the impression that there aren't much that we can do other than take a pill. So there are plenty of social policies that have been successful in reducing nicotine addiction. But for people who find it very difficult, these sorts of treatments are an important addition.
Wayne Hall from the University of Queensland, who's a great supporter of social policies aimed at encouraging smokers to quit. He knows it helps. He kicked the habit 20 years ago in America, when his workplace at the time became smoke-free. He got fed up with huddling outside in the cold and snow. Robert West from University College London says because of the complexities of addiction, there is no magic bullet and nothing works without a strong motivation to quit.
It's really, I think, important to understand that smoking and indeed other addictions involve a combination of psychological and pharmacological and social factors all acting together. And the net result is, and this is what addiction essentially is that the behaviour becomes so strongly integrated and impregnated into a person's life that it takes on a high priority. And that priority overrides other priorities, such as staying alive, for example. And the decision is the starting point. If the decision is one which involves a complete transformation in the way you look at the world, then that can be very, very protective against you going back to smoking. Then you can adjust your life in the first few weeks after stopping smoking to minimise the cues and to make sure that if they do occur, you've got ways of dealing with them so that you don't go back to smoking.
That it's all in your head.
Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless. Not for long, the future.
Robert West from University College London, and before him Professor Wayne Hall from the University of Queensland. And producer Anita Barrow with that update on the efforts to combat cigarette addiction. More on our website at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, along with the audio and later in the week a transcript as per usual. And of course the All in the Mind blog for your thoughts and discussion. A pointer also to Encounter this week. They're exploring faith and depression. That's Sunday mornings at 7 a.m. and Wednesdays at 7 p.m. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for your company. Catch you next week.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast.
ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.